I mean, you can all over the internet, everybody's got their versions of why startups fail. For me, by the time I get to them and they have a product, they fail because they don't have the right people with the right message talking to the right people to make the product successful. And they also don't know how to create a repeatable, scalable process to make sure. And the other thing I've seen them do, and I've actually broken a company. You know, I sold a product that they said could do what customer asked it to do and it couldn't. So to really make sure that you are successful initially, you need to make sure you, when you get out to those initial customers, you deliver, you over deliver, you follow up and start off on the right foot. So now with social media, your reputation is everything. And if you need to make sure that initially you over execute.
You are listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Welcome to Hooked on Startups. So, in this episode, I am absolutely delighted to have Alison Arnoff join us. And Alison, you're with Unfair Advantage Consulting, and we're going to get right into what that means. But Alison, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Let me give you a little bit of background about Alison, and I really want you to fill this in because you've got so much experience. So you've got over 25 years experience in management, in marketing, sales, engineering. I think you're an engineer by trade, so you've been brought up in what must have been one of the hardest sort of communities to excel. And what you do now really is you give startup companies the benefit of all of that experience, that knowledge from being on the inside looking out, and you help startup companies on their journey from the very beginning, and you help them become successful companies, you help them raise capital, you help them understand and avoid all of the bear traps and banana skins that they normally trip over or trip into. Does that sound anything like what you do?
Yeah, that's pretty close. I mean, it really is helping them get out of their own way. And my focus is really on sales and marketing strategy and messaging, is really making sure that public image that you're putting out there is one that can be consumed by people in a way that makes sense. So that's what giving you that unfair advantage is, really giving you that edge out there in the business so you can scale quickly. Because having a great product is one thing, having people buy it is another.
A lot of people talk about business secrets, unfair advantages. The natural assumption that if I'm an entrepreneur and I'm running my business, I know what I'm doing with sales. But in your experience, is that the case?
Well, some do. I mean, some have it figured out. I think the biggest challenge, especially my focus is often with technology companies, is they're so in love with their technology. And they, you know, the way I put it is, it's like they have a PhD in their own technology. They look at this thing every day and they've created their own language. But then they go talk to somebody who wasn't sitting next to them in that PhD class, and they don't understand that they don't get what they're doing. They don't get why their life is better. So having a great technology and having people understand it don't necessarily go hand in hand.
So let's begin at the beginning. So as a typical client that you work with, he'll come to you, and do you focus mainly on tech businesses?
Primarily, because that's my background, though the mistakes can be made across a wide range.
And what do you see? So what do you typically see as the pattern from an early stage? So what sort of stage are companies at when they work with you?
Typically, by the time they get to me, they have some funding and they have some products. Now, I do help some venture capital. People get their venture capital, but my sweet spot is you have a product, you're ready to go big with it, and now you need to come up with the right message, the right strategy, how you're going to court partners, customers, resellers, and make sure that you're scaling quickly.
And so when we say you've got customers, so are you looking at a company that may have received seed funding, for example, has got a early stage product, has got some kind of proof of concept out there?
Yes, typically, because if they don't have funding, they usually can't afford me.
Yeah. Okay.
So basically, by the time they come to me, they have a prototype. They might even have a couple customers, and now they're ready to hire a sales force and really figure out how to expand their business, how to get that curve in the hockey stick.
And do you find that for most of the people that you work with, even though they've got those initial wins, so they've raised the seed capital, so they've got the business off the ground, do you find that it's almost like they've come to a stuttering halt because they don't know how to grow the business or they don't know how to get beyond that proof of concept phase?
Yeah, I mean, what I've noticed is a lot of times those first customers, they had to fly half the company out to acquire them because they haven't come up with a repeatable and scalable process, something that each rep can do, and that you don't need to have the VP of engineering, the founders, everybody go out to do that meeting, because that's not scalable. And so now they're like, okay, I have these salespeople. How do I enable them? How do they set them up to be successful? How do I set up my inside salespeople to actually get meetings so people actually want to talk to us?
I think one of the biggest problems that I've come across with founders is that they're too wedded to being all things to all people, and they find it very difficult to let go and to bring on salespeople. They don't trust the salespeople to do the job properly. So they feel like they have to be doing tech development, alpha testing, beta testing. Hang on a second, let me take my white coat off. I'm going to go and do sales. How much of a problem is it for people who are so entrenched in their product to actually find, how good are founders at finding good salespeople?
Well, it depends on, you know, a lot of founders have done this before, so they have people they've worked with before. But sometimes they find people, the challenge is they find people that have only worked at big companies, and they're used to basically being able to walk in. I have a brand name company, and so everybody will talk to me. And now you call somebody, I mean, my first startup sounded like a law firm. So when I had to call people and say who I was working for, they didn't know who I was. They didn't want to speak to me. I didn't have a brand name. So that's a shift that a lot of salespeople and sales management don't know how to make, where they're not invited to the party. They have to earn their way into the meeting.
And what do you think is the biggest challenge that a startup has? So what is the first thing that you always seem to find is the common sort of element, which is the first major issue that you have to deal with sort of tech startups?
They don't know how to message their product in a way that the customer understands how their life is going to be better because of it. They want to tell them how much work they did and all these cool bells and whistles, but the customer, the one who has the actual budget to buy the product, maybe the engineers want to hear that, but the guy with the CIO or the CFO with money, he wants to know, why is his company, why is his business, why is his life better because this technology will be in place?
And how critical is that? Because it sounds very simple.
It's everything. I mean, it's everything. Can you imagine, I was thinking of an example of this, when the iPod came out, can you imagine if they marketed it and said, we have this technology that has the biggest advancements in memory density and access so you can play music, versus that ad of somebody going out there dancing with this portable thing?
Yes.
I mean, can you imagine if they led with the technology?
I think the second one would be better. The dancing one would probably, that's right. But no, listen, it's funny, we make fun of this, but there are so many companies out there that, and I come across them all the time, where they position themselves based on how clever we are and how we've made use of this, you know, this technology. So how do you begin that conversation? So what do you look for? What are the first steps that you take in identifying how to get your companies from seed stage into mass market adoption?
Well, the first is, I call it gold mining. There's so much data. Companies don't realize that they already have the data they need to be successful. And so by interviewing founders, investors, any customers, partners, resellers, engineering, marketing, you go gold mining for nuggets. And you really can build a profile of the real reason people want the product. And it's not because it's fast. It's not because it's small. It's because something is going to transition that company to be able to do better. I mean, I listened to, I think, was it Louis Diskin that you had on a few weeks ago? And he made a great statement. People are already making money without you.
Yes.
And that was a really powerful statement. So you have to go into these clients with a way, I understand that you're already successful. I think I can help you be better. But sometimes startups go in there with, I have the greatest thing. I'm going to change your life. they're already, life's pretty good already. And you have to remember that when you go in.
And so, and do you find that this is the point where a lot of startups actually fail? Because I think the failure rate in not just tech startups, but startups generally, we were talking about this when we met a few weeks back, but it's a fairly horrendous figure.
It's a horrendous figure for a few reasons. One is they don't know their market. There's no market for what they do. It's something cool, but there's not a market for it. You don't have the right people. You might have a great idea, but you can't deliver. I mean, there's lots of reasons. But if you actually have a technology that does what it's supposed to do, to me, what I see the biggest failure is the inability to get it in the right customer's hands with the right message so that they want to have it. Because when you go out and present a customer, you want them not only to understand what you do, you want them to come out of that meeting like, I have to have it. And that's rare for people to be able to do that.
And also from a VC's perspective, so do you find that a lot of startups have this sort of idea that they're going to be the next unicorn, that is something that they need to shoot for, that there's no middle ground, that they have to take over the world? Or do you find the more sensible ones tend to think, well, let's do this in stages? Or do you find that part of what you do is this educational process to get people to understand the relevance of their product?
Well, it's a little bit of both, right? Because there has to be a large enough market for the product for a VC to be interested. However, you need to have an incremental marketing plan. Think about Facebook. It just started with Harvard. And then he went to some of the other Ivy Leagues and then Stanford before he went broad. So there was nothing about it that couldn't be ubiquitous for everybody initially, but it was the ability to say, I'm going to focus on a segment, be successful there, and then grow. And I think that's one of the things that I see when they come to pitch, because I also sit on a VC panel, is they say, everybody can buy it. Okay, how are you going to market it? How are you going to get into people's hands? What segment are you going to start with, be successful, and then expand from?
What are the typical sorts of problems or normal mistakes that people make? Things like the, you know, if 1% of the population buy my product, then we'll be trillionaires. Do you get a lot of that sort of approach?
Yeah, I work with an organization and I do some pro bono on their early pitches. And every one of them, I've had to send the document on the TAM, SAM, which is total available market, strategic available market, and serviceable market. And they don't know that because they think it's a total available market. If you have a product, you come up with a new soap.
Yeah.
Everybody can use that soap, but there has to be a niche that's going to adopt it, that low-hanging fruit that's going to get you traction. And a lot of people don't know how to express that when they go to VCs for money.
And how important is the understanding of the market in the cycle? Because do you find that a lot of startups will just develop their product in a vacuum and then get it to the point where there is something wrong with the world if they don't buy it? And how brutal do you need to be with some of your clients to get them to understand that how they need to reposition themselves?
That's funny. I had a client recently who just wasn't listening, and just their message was so complex, and they actually had a great technology. And I actually had to go to the president and say, I have a master's in engineering and parallel processing and fault-tolerant computer design. If I don't understand what you're trying to communicate, I guarantee you 95% of the population does not either. And that was finally the thing that got him to wake up. Because he goes, well, I don't want to dumb down my product. It's not about dumbing down your product. It's about creating a message that people understand the value of your product.
I think one of the real issues is that the view that founders have about the importance of sales and marketing is seen to be secondary to the importance of technology. And again, how do you get your clients? How do you manage to convince them that you're going to run out of money, crash and burn in a matter of weeks, and no one will ever see, your product will never see the light of day unless you understand the reality of life, which is if no one's going to buy this product, then you're wasting your time. So my question is really, how do you find these people at the stage before it's too late?
Well, I mean, that's the challenge, right? Because, you know, hopefully you get to the VCs and the VCs either have mentors or they have people like me in their stable that they bring in, because good VCs are adept at spotting a good technology, but they're also adept at spotting the weaknesses of the companies. And so a lot of them do have their own panel of advisors to help them, or they have outside people, consultants like me. And they, you know, in some cases, I'm a prerequisite when a company's funded by one of the VCs that they have to work with me to make sure that they're successful.
And let's talk about VCs as well, because the VC approach is very much, it seems, a case of numbers. So, you know, we're looking for that 10x, 20x, 100x. But what do you find VCs look for in companies where they're at such an early stage that you can't tell if the product or technology is going to work?
Well, a big part of that is looking for the people. You invest in the people initially, because even if this idea might not be the idea, you know that this team is going to be successful. And you know that they are looking at things, they're looking at problems, they're looking at gaps, they're looking at pains, and looking for a way to solve things to make lives better for people. Whether it's in technology or in consumer products, they're looking for gaps. And so you start with people.
And it's the ability for the team to be flexible, to pivot, to understand that not everything is going to go according to plan. So, and what do you think, in your experience, are the types of teams that really stand out as being the ones that you would put your money on?
Well, usually they have, for me, I'd like to see a good business and technical combination. You'd like to have seen some history between them before, so you know that they're going to stay together. I'd like to see that they are open to other, they're proud of what they do, but they don't, their ego doesn't get in the way. I think that's one of the biggest things. When you sit in a VC panel, they come in there and they know it all. And they're not open. And what they don't realize is the people across the table have such experience that they could take advantage of.
And I think you're right, because I remember watching Social Network, you know, the story of Facebook and how Mark Zuckerberg went to a VC wearing his pajamas just to prove a point. Do you find that there is still that feeling that I'm a tech startup, I'm going to be the next Uber, but obviously without the political issues, or the next Airbnb? Or are people beginning to understand that it's just the very beginning of the process to actually get the tech off the ground?
Well, it's just a wide spectrum. I mean, I've seen them all sitting at this panel. And I think that for the majority of them that come in there are have some humility and understand that there are some great people sitting across the table that not only have money, but have knowledge. Now, but there are always the one or two that just walk in there and they know it all. And there's nothing we can do because we're older and we're not a millennial and we don't understand. Just give us the money and we'll make you money. But that's, I'd say that's becoming less common as time goes on.
And you talk about, you know, the top sins. You mentioned ego just now. Let's go through some of the things that you spot. So if anyone's listening to this and it resonates with you, you know, this is you we're talking about here. So if any of this stuff here sounds familiar, then you know, you probably need to sort of change what you're doing. So things like just being in love with your tech or being incredibly grateful for the sale where you send flowers to the person because you're so, you know, overwhelmed that they've actually bought your widget. Or what are the things that make you cringe when people start saying it?
You know, what makes me cringe is when I ask them what their product does and they lead with the technical features. Like I using the iPod example, well, it's denser memory and faster access time versus the experience that they're going to have. The gratitude selling, what I call it, is that when you're a startup and you're trying to get meetings, you're so happy that somebody wants to talk to you. You have no idea if you're even talking to the right key stakeholder, someone that has budget, someone that has a problem. You don't even know if you're relevant. You're just so happy that somebody actually wants to talk to you. And I've worked at companies and I've watched a lot of junior salespeople do that because they have their statistics. They have to show their bosses every week of how many sales calls they went on. And they don't realize that I'd rather go on one call and have it be the right call to the right stakeholder with budget and problem than just a bunch of people that are grateful, that are curious. Because when you have a new technology, people want to see it. People are naturally curious. That doesn't mean they've earned the right to see it yet. If you haven't done your basic selling, which is discovering, you know, are they the right person and do they have a problem that you can solve?
And you mentioned earlier about how some companies talk about the massive scalability that their technology has, yet to make a sale, they need to fly half the team across the country. So yeah, as long as we can be in 1,000 places at once, we're going to make a we're going to make a killing.
Well, and you know, if you have a technical product, at some point you're going to have to bring the technical people in. That's just a reality. I think if you do things right, you could have filtered out a lot of clients and really focus on the right ones by the time you get there. You do that by arming your salespeople with the right message. If you can arm the people up front, they can really make sure they got to somebody that has a real problem, has budget, has the authority to make a decision. And then he can say, if this does what it says, you say it does, I can see how my business will improve. Let's now bring in the technical people to evaluate it. But that should be, the technical people should be at the end of the process and not at the beginning.
So do you find that what you do when you work with companies is you completely turn them on their head almost? So is it like a drains up, okay, everything you've done is wrong so far. I mean, congratulations on raising your initial capital, but you know, just stop what you're doing. We need to rebuild everything. Is that where you come in?
Yeah, I don't always tell them they're wrong. I say, you have a great product. Let's take all the goodness of it and create a message so that people want to have it. They have to have it. They know that their life is going to be improved. Their competitive edges, they're going to improve their competition against their competition. So yeah, I don't get a lot of clients by telling them they're wrong. I'm telling them they have a great idea. And
well, the thing is, you sign them up first, get them committed on the contract, and then tell them they're wrong. That's probably the safe way to do it.
Right. Well, in that one case I mentioned before, I did have to tell them you're wrong, and that actually worked, and the contract was sent the next day. But for the most part, if you have to find people that, there's a great quote I learned, that understand they can't see the label from inside the bottle.
And absolutely, so you're right. Absolutely.
And so you've got to find people that are open. I think you talk about the one-on-one, you know, the sins that you see them do, the problems, is they don't ask for outside help. I mean, we both were at this event where Marcus Lemonis was speaking last week, and he even said, "You we're in the weeds. You need to see somebody. Somebody needs to help you that's not in the weeds." And so that's where the ego comes in. You know, I talk to clients, and they don't need help, and I'll call them in 6 months and see how they're doing. But a lot of people are understanding that a set of external eyes, someone that's not looking at this thing so closely every day, might see things that they're not seeing. Plus, you know, since I do this interview process with, you know, the different stakeholders, founders, investors, existing customers, partners, they'll probably tell me things they're not going to tell the client.
And so I wouldn't describe you as a coach, though. I mean, not to demean sort of coaching, but it just seems that what you do is just so much more powerful than just sort of coaching someone. You're actually flying in, you're providing this real sleeves up, right, let's get stuck into this company. You need to do this, this, and this. And listen to me, because I know what I'm talking about, because I've been doing it for the last 25 years with some huge success. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it's not coaching. It really is going there. It's consulting. It's extracting data. It's taking what we learn and applying it, whether it's coming up with a new sales presentation, whether it's coming up with a prescriptive approach for the inside sales to improve their success in getting meetings, whether it's redoing the content of your website, it could be your collateral, it just could be your whole brand. It has to be turned in a way that resonates with the people that have money, not the engineers.
And what you're doing though, but you're not just going in from a marketing perspective saying you need to make your presentation a bit prettier. You're actually digging much deeper and you're saying...
It's about the content. It's about the message. There's a lot of people out there that can go make everything pretty. My job isn't to make it pretty and make it packaged nice and have pretty blue borders on it. It's really going in there and digging deep and really understanding. You created this product for a reason. Let's get back to that basic reason you created this product. You saw a problem out there. Now that we've gone back to the fundamentals of what this problem is, how do we make sure that people not only understand that and feel that pain, but need to solve it? So when you come out with a message for a client, I start always with what's the possible, the world, what could happen? And then why aren't you there? And you need to let your, you know, when you're selling to people, you need to let your prospective clients marinate in the pain. And then you can sit there and come in and say, now this is how I solve your pain. But so many people just want to come in there and start with the how and the what of the technology. And they need to go back to the why. And there's a great TED talk about that, why, what, and how. It's really about the why. And I help them find their why.
And the why in terms of the product as well. I mean, so you have the why of the product. In other words, you know, what pain does this solve? Why is this of use to anyone? But also, do you find over time this, that the founders lose their direction because they get, they sort of pivot so many times. Do you find that what you also do helps them get back on track with their original vision?
The original vision shouldn't change. I mean, the pivot might, you know, there's a problem out there. There's a general pain. You might be tuning that. And, you know, they say most companies pivot three times, but usually there's a general segment problem that you're trying to solve. And you just need to get back to its purest form and just not be so in love with yourself. And that's the biggest challenge is, you know, you should. Congratulations, right? You have come up with a great idea. I'm not there. I'm on the other side, right? You're the one that had that brainstorm, and that's brilliant. Now let's figure out how to make sure everybody else understands the brilliance of it.
And this is not just limited to tech companies. I know we've been talking specifically about tech companies, but your experience goes way beyond just tech. I mean, do you find that's a common problem?
It is a common problem. I think for me, there's two real markets. There's products that go towards businesses and products that go towards consumers. Consumer is a lot about brand, color, pretty pictures, cute sayings. So my sweet spot is really anybody that sells to a business. It doesn't have to be a pure tech product. But businesses are trying to figure out how to make money, save money, streamline operations, adapt to the changing world. And so companies need to figure out how to address that for them.
And is there a particular process that you have found very successful in terms of changing a founder's mindset so that they recruit the best people? What are the big issues? Is it recruitment? Is it communications?
From a sales standpoint, you got to start with the right people. And these are people that come from a world where they understand that they're not going to get invited in. And these are people that are tenacious, that don't understand the word no. And to find, there's a lot of good salespeople out there. I've watched a lot of really senior salespeople that have come from some of the best pedigree companies out there fail miserably at startups because their strength was once the meeting was set up for them, they knew how to drive the story home. But when you're at a startup, people don't know you. They don't trust you. And you need to find a way to create that trust and have them want to have you come in there and talk to them. So it's really finding people that's a very different skill. You know, they're called hunters in sales terminology. To find true hunters out there is what a startup has to have initially.
Yes. And does every company you work with succeed?
Well, I haven't been doing this this long. So far, so good. They're all doing well. Every company I've seen has not succeeded. I was at an event and somebody sitting next to me that knew what I did said, you should talk to that guy. He needs your help. And I said, nope, can't help him. There's people you look at and you just know you can't help them because they're all over the map. They're not going to see it or they don't have a great idea. I saw one of the best pitches done and I want to hire their graphic designer for who did their deck, but there was no problem they were solving.
And do you think that's the, and again, coming back to this perception of ego or the why, do you find that there is a common reason in your experience why startups, whether they're tech startups or business startups generally, is there something that you've seen that's a common thread that causes these companies to fail?
No, I mean, you can all over the internet, everybody's got their versions of why startups fail. For me, by the time I get to them and they have a product, they fail because they don't have the right people with the right message, talking to the right people to make the product successful. And they also don't know how to create a repeatable, scalable process to make sure. And the other thing I've seen them do, and I've actually broken a company. You know, I sold a product that they said could do what customer asked it to do and it couldn't. So to really make sure that you are successful initially, you need to make sure you, when you get out to those initial customers, you deliver, you over-deliver, you follow up and start off on the right foot. So now with social media, your reputation is everything. And if you need to make sure that initially you over-execute.
And how useful do you think some of the crowdfunding platforms like Indiegogo and Kickstarter are to help businesses verify whether their product has real demand or not?
I've seen those more for consumer products. I haven't seen a lot of that in the industry that I'm in because often people that I talk to might be looking for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 million initially, which is not typically the sweet spot for those. A lot of those campaigns I see for people who want to develop a prototype of something that's more consumer-based versus a prototype of something that a Disney or a Toyota or a Kaiser, you know, the big companies are going to want to adopt. But I see them being very successful. It's given people who have never, who would never have gotten a meeting with a VC or had access, a way to really get out there and do a market test with and see before they go out there and commit their life and their life savings to it. So it's, they're beautiful platforms. Don't necessarily see them in the high tech space that I'm mainly in.
And let's go back a little bit, because you were talking really in terms of some fairly big figures there, you know, $30 to $50 million. To a lot of early stage companies or to a lot of founders with this idea, that seems a fairly unachievable figure. In other words, it seems like there's a massive gap between where I am now with this idea, with this team, with this drive. But give us some idea about how these things actually do work and the sort of process that you would go through as a founder with an idea, and how it is possible to very quickly get up to those sorts of valuations and to get some face time with VCs who would be very interested in your product.
Well, again, it goes back to the market, what the market opportunity is for it. If the total market opportunity for your product is $50 million, you're not going to be going to these guys for that. So this is really for these, you know, really large enterprise technologies that play in that kind of space. You really need to be able to show the VCs your plan. This is what I'm going to do with the first, I need $1 million. Typically what I see, about $1 million to $1.5 million to get started. Have a very clear vision, know how long it's going to last you, what you're going to use it for, when it's going to run out, what you're going to need next. I mean, it's really showing them that you understand the steps and that they can trust you with that money. And once those are the kind of people that when we see those, we definitely invite them back for a second or third look, because they're realistic.
Yeah. And I guess that's and it's amazing how quickly the snowball effect takes place. So in your experience, have you seen, typically what is the timescale that someone can go from having an idea to getting early adoption to being in front of a VC who's willing to write a $50 million check?
Well, you know, so much of what you see out there is software now, right? And software definitely does not take as long as hardware products to get out there. And so, you know, you want to get something called an MVP, right? A minimal viable product, something that you can start showing people to get their acceptance. And from idea to that, you know, if you go outside and hire some people, there's so many people just chomping at the bit to do that work for you. You can have that in 3 to 6 months in somebody's hand to start playing with it and start getting some ideas. Now, the more advanced stuff that's going towards the enterprise space might be more 18 months to 2 years to really get to that point. But it depends on what the product is. An app is one thing. Something that's going to change the way someone does a billing system, finance, will probably take a little bit longer because there's a lot more security and other issues that are involved in those types of products.
And do you find that your business is focusing much more on blockchain, cryptocurrencies, not so much cryptocurrencies, but sort of blockchain style technologies, which is, you know, very much the buzz term of the moment? Are you seeing a rush of these types of technologies?
You know, ironically, I actually avoid those right now. I'm staying more in the traditional lane because I think that's really, and again, the enterprise space, I haven't seen a lot of companies use those methodologies to play in that space yet. I learn about it. I keep an eye on it. If it does make sense for me at some point, it's interesting. It's definitely an interesting, but for me, there's enough in the traditional lane for me right now that I'm going to stay in something that I feel is a little more safe and predictable at this point.
Well, and you're right. And also something that where you can add real value because you're leveraging the knowledge and experience that you have. Right. But I think what you really have is an incredibly positive message, because there's definitely help, there's a roadmap. So for, I suppose, startups that find that they can only get some so far before they run out of knowledge, basically. So, you know, they've found that they've hit this metaphorical wall because they just don't know what to do next. You kind of kick in at that point and you lead them onto what could be huge valuations.
Hopefully, that's the goal, right? And if you look at tech companies, I kind of see a progression that happens. First, you have a great technology, and so you hire the engineers. And then you got to start getting in people's hands, so you hire sales. The last leg is the marketing. But often that first marketing person is really somebody that's figuring out what trade shows to go to, what color to be the website, that image. What's missing and the gap that I fill in is that marketing person that can understand sales process, sales methodology, has been in the trenches, has been, you know, I've been not too long ago, I was actually on the street doing this, so not so far removed from the day-to-day operations. So there's a gap there that I fill, because right now they don't have the money to really expand out and hire somebody to do that. And because what I do is tune-ups, you don't need to have like somebody from one of these big consulting firms live there for 6-9 months. We're talking a week or two of coming in there and doing deep dive inspection, really hard work, making sure these resources are available, and send you on your way. So it's a very quick turnaround when you have somebody from the outside with a different perspective that asks different questions in a new way. Does that gold mining that we talked about before give you your nuggets and send you back out in the field?
Which I think must be just so refreshing, because to know that you've got that week of kind of being able to tap into distilled wisdom and not feel like you've got this long drawn out death by a thousand cuts with a consultant.
Well, it's also, you also have only so much money to spend. And so be able to do a shorter term tune-up. If you think about the average sale of my customers, my tune-up could be just getting one additional sale. They could be getting 10 to 20X the value just with one additional sale. So this isn't a big drain on the resources that you have to get this kind of tune-up.
Which is fabulous. Wow. I mean, I think it's incredible what you do. I can just see the sense of relief that a lot of people listening to this are feeling, that there is hope. That, I mean, what advice would you give if you had one piece of advice to people listening to this that feel like they just can't figure out what to do next to get over this wall? Is there something that you could say to help them move it?
The biggest thing I would say is there are people that have done this. Seek out the wisdom out there. You don't have to do it yourself. You're not weak going out and saying, I need help. There is so much knowledge, so many people, and not to be self-serving, people like me, it doesn't have to be me. There's so many mentors, advisors, successful people out there that can give you that one thing, that one aha moment that's just going to pivot everything for you and send you on this accelerated path. So, you know, ask for help.
I think that's absolutely brilliant advice, because I think so many entrepreneurs just don't do that. They try and do it all on their own, and they just run out of time, they run out of money, or they run out of roadway.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it takes more strength to ask for help than it does to do it yourself. But you're not, it's just, there's so many people out there that have just, they've done it.
And that's a key thing. I think the key thing is to ask for help from someone who has done it, who's done what you want to do. So rather than trying to find someone who can give you general advice. So that's why what you do is so important, because you've walked a mile in their shoes.
Yeah, you don't go to somebody who's broke for financial advice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You really got to make sure, you know, find someone that, you know, whether it's, what I do is not industry specific, but if you need technology help, if you're stuck, get a technologist that's been out there. Sales and marketing, somebody like me, you've never been an executive before, you don't know how to be a CEO. There's so many CEO groups now where you can go and meet peers. There's so much with meetups and so many different masterminds, so many different ways to get help. There's not one way, but find the way that, you know, figure out what the next thing you need to do is that's going to make things better, and then go find someone to help you with that.
And you're right, it's not a sign of weakness.
Well, no. I mean, look, like I said, as someone like Marcus Lemonis, if people don't know who that is, you know, who owns so many companies right now, he asks for help regularly. He knows that he doesn't know everything. You know, the smart people know that they don't know everything. They know that they know some things really well. They know what their lane is, but when they need to get out of their lane, they ask for help.
And I think that's really good advice, because I think it doesn't matter what stage company you're at, you need advice, you need help, because perspective, what you're talking about earlier, you can't see the label if you're inside the bottle. I think that must be, you must have so many different occasions where that has become true.
Right. You know, and I'm a big fan of Tony Robbins, and he always said, find someone who's where you want to be and ask them how they got there.
And, you know, it is as simple as that. And in your experience, do people share? Are people, successful people, willing to share?
Oh, yes. It's such a generous community. There's so many people out there. I mean, there's so many people that, you know, want to make sure that technology grows here and that we continue to have a technology leadership and advance our country and move things forward. So, I mean, you're not going to go to your direct competitor. But, you know, in general, I find it to be a very generous community with people out there that want to help. I mean, I do a lot of pro bono for really early stage for one organization, because I'm excited to see these people that come up with these great ideas, and I want to give them bootstrapped and send them on their way. So it's a very generous community.
And I think that's absolutely right, because people assume that nobody wants to help them because they're afraid of competing with them. And do you find that some of the lesser experienced entrepreneurs or technologists tend to be they like to hold their technology very close to their chest. So they fear that people will steal their tech.
Well, it's good to be paranoid. I worked for Intel during the great Andy Grove timeframe, and he was the CEO during Intel when they just exploded. And he had a saying, only the paranoid survive. And so you do need to be paranoid, but there's the right kind of paranoid. You need to be paranoid that no matter how great your idea is, somebody else is going to probably come up with something, or they're, once they hear about it, are going to try, no matter how many patents you have. So there's a paranoia that someone's going to come up behind you and you need to stay ahead. Being paranoid to get help, again, find the right people. Be smart about who you choose. So I believe that companies in general today are not paranoid enough. And I've seen companies lose their first mover advantage because they weren't paranoid enough and they didn't bring people in to help them with that pivot. But to be paranoid to ask for help, just do your homework and find the right people.
Which is brilliant advice. Well, Alison, thank you. We are now at that point in the interview where I need to ask you my 10 questions.
Okay.
So these are the real critical questions here, not about sort of marketing and pivoting. This is what matters. So, and again, thanks again to James Lipton from the Inside the Actors Studio for giving me the opportunity of borrowing your questions. I promise to return them unharmed and unused. So the first question is, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word is hello.
Okay.
Because it's the start of something new, a new conversation, a new experience.
Oh, wonderful. And so what is your least favorite word?
My least favorite word is but. And so I, I learned in a class I took that instead of but, replace it with and. So you're not negating what that person did. You're just adding to it. So I don't like the word but. I replaced it with and.
I know what you mean. It's like it's all going so well until you said that word.
Yes. And in fact, I'm not a Game of Thrones fan, but when I was sharing this question with somebody, they told me that I guess Jon Snow basically said his dad told him not to start listening to someone until he heard the word but.
Yeah, and by the way, that's not a Game of Thrones spoiler if anyone's worried about that. Okay.
But I like the word and because it's an additive and you're not negating anything. You're not giving any negative feedback to that person. You're helping them grow.
That's brilliant. So what are you excited about right now?
I left corporate America a little over a year ago to go out on my own. And the window to the world that I've been invited to see, it's just amazing what instead of one company for 18 months, 2 or 4 years, I get to see so much in a week, and it's just brilliant. And I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to see all of this.
Brilliant. And what turns you off right now?
This vitriol-based Pavlovian response to anybody that has a different view or opinion than you that we're going through in this country right now. We're living in a black and white world, and the magic happens in the gray. And I'm hoping we can get back to the magic.
Oh, that's wonderful. So what sound or noise do you love?
Unobstructed nature. It could be the ocean. It could be the wind when I'm hiking. I love getting out in nature. So just listening to nature without any man-made sounds is just beautiful.
And what noise or sound do you hate?
I live on a street that a lot of people seem to want to drag race down at 2-3 in the morning. So when they realize there's a stop sign at my street, the screeching right there is just it's just awful.
Are you not tempted to sort of paint slow down signs, or?
Well, I'm involved in local politics and know our mayor, so I'm trying to figure out, can we get speed bumps put on there so that they can't do that anymore?
Yeah, that'll give them a shock. So what is your favorite curse word? It's probably related, I would have thought.
it's fuck. Yeah. I mean, it's basically a good catch-all. I know a lot of that's the same for a lot of your guests, but it's just a great catch-all. It can answer a lot of questions.
But it is, you're right. For and we know all the reasons, the verb, the adjective, the adverb is superb. So what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I would, if I was an elite athlete in the day, and if I was still in that form, I would have loved to be an American Ninja Warrior if they had those, but they didn't start until I was past my prime. And that would be something I would just love. I'm a big fan.
Amazing. And what profession would you not like to attempt?
I would not want to do anything in the medical profession because I'm extremely squeamish.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's well, you know, I suppose engineering is sort of mechanical and biological engineering, different things.
Well, you know, and I'm a backpacker, adventure traveler out doing all that stuff. But, you know, you can describe a cut to me and I'll get squeamish.
That's right. So if anyone's listening, remember, that's the secret weapon.
Exactly.
My final question is, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Great job. You're ready for round two?
Fantastic. Well, that's super, Alison. I can't thank you enough. My last question is, how do people find you? How do they get in touch with you? How do they read about you? How do they hear and how do they engage you?
Well, the name of my business is Unfair Advantage Consulting. So the two ways to get a hold of me are, one is the website, which is unfairadvantage.consulting, not .com, or they can email me at Alison@unfairadvantage.consulting with one L. And if your listeners email me now, I'm going to be starting a whole new blog series, and they can get an early copy of my first blog, is Why You Didn't Get a Second Date, which is really about why you didn't get a second meeting, but in the context of the dating world.
Oh, fantastic. That's brilliant. Wow. Well, it's been marvelous having you on. And, you know, I look forward to following your progress and reading all about it. And, you know, hopefully speak to you again soon.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed our time together.
That's brilliant. Thanks.